Wakanda forever!
Winter's coming.
Alexis, now is not the time for pettifogging.
Advertising is based on one thing. Happiness.
We were never married. We had an arrangement, and it worked.
Jesus and Santa were cousins. Everybody knows this.
Now you're in the sunken place.
Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Brandon. Welcome to our first live Pop Rocket. We are here at Camilleri Hall at USC, and you children better know how to applaud in an audience. You're the ones who decided to go to school in Los Angeles. We are going to be picking over all the pop culture we love to love. And with me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello. You're so low energy, and I need you to bring it up a notch.
Bring it up a notch. Get hyper.
You guys live in Los Angeles. You should understand how to do room tone and then come alive. We've also got journalist and novelist Margaret Wappler.
Hello there, Guy.
Hello, Margaret. What are you looking forward to from this first live podcasting experience?
Well, we're going to try to keep out of the scandal pages because I know it's been a little rough for you guys lately. We'll see. We'll see. It might get controversial.
We'll do our best. And we've also got pop culture scholar and a person you might know, Professor Karen Toxin.
Hi, Guy. Hi, Rocketeers.
Karen, I'm deeply offended that Laura did not bring the rest of us out with credits. Like, the audience is very much playing to you right now.
Well,
you have home field advantage.
I mean, they are ultimately responsible to me for their grades. But, nothing like that ever happens here where people ingratiate themselves to people in power in order to get what they want.
You guys are going to be just fine.
Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be talking about why pop culture matters to us as well as in the grander scheme of things. We're also going to chat with you guys about what aspects of the last decade of pop culture might stand the test of time and end up being taught to future generations of students who take this class if your professor hasn't been turned into a hologram and if the universities exist. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Margaret Wappler. What are you all about this week?
Oh, I got so into the Theranos documentary, which debuted on HBO earlier this week. If you guys don't know the story of Theranos, please get into it because it gives you everything you could possibly want. Just imagine the Billy McFarlane Firefest disaster, but transfer it over to things that actually matter, like healthcare and blood testing. So Elizabeth Holmes was this 19-year-old Stanford dropout. She starts a business because she wants to revolutionize the way we test for blood. Instead of doing the whole needle draw, she wants to just prick your finger and get a few drops and test from there. Problem is, she doesn't have the actual technology. She doesn't have this machine invented, but she's already come up with a name for it, the Edison. She starts collecting money. She gets these incredible backers, this board of directors like Henry Kissinger and former Secretary of State, also George Shultz. All these people that really don't have experience in medicine at all, but bought her sales pitch 100%. She starts a huge company in Silicon Valley. At one point, her wealth was estimated at like $4.5 billion, her own personal wealth for holding 50% stake in this company. And then the floor just falls out from underneath her, basically because she just didn't have the actual technology to do what she was promising. And it's a look from Alex Gibney, who directed the documentary about Enron. It's a look at basically how this company, which was shrouded in secrecy and paranoia, basically just destroyed itself over the past couple years.
Have any of you guys considered careers in corporate fraud? It feels like it's one of America's like growth industries these days.
It's true, yeah, and it's a millennial path that you can follow.
But don't you think that us telling stories, like The Social Network, telling stories of sort of like boom economics, like creates people like Elizabeth Holmes and Billy McFarland who are just writing on the narrative instead of actual production?
Yeah, I mean, I just wrote about this for Slate and it's going to appear, I think, tomorrow. But basically, like, you know, Elizabeth Holmes and McFarland and a lot of other millennials of that age kind of grew up on the cult of positive thinking. You know, nobody ever saying no. Basically, everyone saying, you can do this. This can
happen.
You're
a baby genius. Mm. You're amazing.
Yeah, you're a genius. You're amazing. And this is what happens when millennial influencer culture meets, like, old school male hubris, basically. So, yeah, I mean.
Well, also good for her that she is participating in male hubris. It's worked for us for so long.
Yes.
But also, like, one of the things that was most fascinating to me, and there are so many other details about this story that seems to have captured the popular imagination, like her penchant for turtlenecks, a la
yes.
Steve Jobs.
Steve Jobs cosplay, as I like to
call it. Yeah, and also, like, her the voice that she apparently affected in order to, I guess, have people take her more seriously?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say to you guys that I interviewed Elizabeth Holmes in 2015 for Elle, and I was really just puzzled throughout this whole interview, and I just
did she blink?
She barely she blinked, and I was like, are you a hostage who's trying to communicate to me with only one blink per, like, 5 minutes? If so, okay, I'm hearing the code. But then also, like, she had this voice.
We've made it possible to eliminate the tubes and tubes of blood that traditionally have to be drawn from an arm and replaced it with the nanotainer.
And I just was like, something's off here. And so I watched her in the news from that point forward and just was like aghast at what ended up happening.
Can I tell you the scariest part of the entire documentary for me as a huge consumer of like fast grocery stores is that she corrupted Walgreens. Like she literally made them buy into her bullshit and then they were like, we've never touched bodily fluids before. And so then they had to like get rid of it and they took up huge spaces and they were the first ones to be like, no.
Yeah, that was her first big collaborator. And when I saw those signs going up in Walgreens, I was like, ooh, I hope she's got that blood machine figured out.
Exactly. The last thing I will say about her specifically and the voice is that someone on Twitter really pegged it and said she stole the voice from Romy and Romy and Michelle's high school.
100%. Have you guys ever seen that?
Yeah.
Okay, a couple people.
Post notes. Yeah.
And then, and the one last thing is that recently I had like a health screening. Actually, it was here on campus, but they also only took a thimble full of blood for me and gave me several test results. There were only 6, not 200 different blood test results. And it wasn't a U.S., it was an outside company. And I'm wondering, because I remember I marveled at that little machine when they, and I was like, was that real? You know, like I'm now doubting whether or not that whole experience was real.
Well, in the same way that like speculative fiction can imagine our future, fraud can also imagine a possible future. Winter Mitchell, what are you all about this week?
How many of you guys are actually going to try to work in the entertainment business?
Okay, this is a podcast. I'm going to need you guys to clap when you want to indicate yes. A raised hand is meaningless in a non-visual medium. Learn that before you go into entertainment, okay?
The one thing that you need to know about entertainment when you're going in is like the pop culture of it is all fun and games, but you going behind the curtain is where you really need to start knowing how the players are and how they play. So today, Fox, as we know it, is no longer, you know, Fox Studios, who's made all your like Daredevil and whatnot. They've all changed and split off in a merger. So now Fox is just talking about news, sports, and they've lost their Hulu, they've lost their share in Hulu, they lost all their big studios that produce like television shows, all your favorite TV shows that originated from Fox, except for The Simpsons. They kept The Simpsons. And they're now owned by Disney. So some of your Marvel people, sorry, that's my phone. Some of those movies that you like that are usually under the Marvel universe are now gonna be under Disney. The reason why this is interesting and important for you guys to even think for 2 seconds about is media conglomeration and companies splitting up and then becoming smaller and sort of owned by one person. I think you should really take a look at this merger because it's probably one of the biggest mergers to happen in your short young life. The thing that I think is so interesting about it, but I'm really fascinated by it, and I've been reading all the stories and sort of following it and sort of the politics align with it. Now that Fox is just going to be Fox News and their sports, the sports companies that they're going to own, the networks that they're going to own, Paul Ryan is joining the board of Fox News. So that starts to affect, and Donna Brazile was hired, who's a Democratic strategist. Fox hiring a Democratic strategist when you know where they're leaning, and then Sean Hannity's like, maybe I'll leave. You're going to see a lot of things that...
Please do leave, Sean.
Please do leave. You're going to see a lot of things change. Like when I was 17, this happened with a couple of companies, NBC, Universal, Comcast, all those different. It's going to start affecting like how you digest content.
It's very interesting that these are your all-abouts because they are two sides of the same story. America loves to tell this story of the entrepreneur who does the magnificent thing like in a brief period of time. And during the period of time that we have like most recently loved telling that story, we've essentially given up on antitrust law and
yes.
Had this kind of
Bill
consolidation. And the Donna Brazile thing is really interesting because so frequently when media companies are going into a merger, when they know that there's going to be government scrutiny on them, they start hiring people or greenlighting stuff that makes it look like they are way more chill.
Yeah.
Like in 2013, I worked on a late night show that was hosted by like a progressive African-American comic. And it got canceled not long after Fox's merger got approved. And there was a lot of speculation that that just existed to show that this consolidation of the market wasn't going to impact diversity of the market and that it was more PR than anything else. I got paid, so that's cool.
Well, one thing I wanted to also add is that this is a very fitting follow-up or all about from our lecture earlier this week on Monday, which our wonderful TA Shannon Zhao, give it up for her, gave us a lecture about how historically in the early 2000s this was starting to really become like a major concern around entertainment and media, and so we just went through that lesson, and to have these things just perpetually repeat themselves and become even more acute is, like, I think, super fascinating. Thank you for consolidating my curriculum here, Winter.
You guys should really start looking and noticing things will change in the next few months. Just how the jokes, the in-jokes that'll happen. I really wish, like, David Letterman and Jay Leno were still here because they'd have a field day with stuff like this. Don't worry about it. They're before your time. But there's...
Maybe Jimmy Fallon will play a game of charades about it.
Exactly.
Karen, am I allowed to call you Karen?
Yeah, of course.
Right. Karen.
You can call me Karen.
What are both of us all about this week?
Well, so comes to pass that Guy Branum and I, who essentially share a very similar mind and a similar taste in clothing that would be adult clothing that would fit toddlers, basically, that we're both really excited about Shrill, a new Hulu original series created by friend of Pop Rocket and author Lindy West, and also co-produced by Adie Bryant and a bunch of other big names like Elizabeth Banks and Lorne Michaels. And it's only 6 episodes, but it's been a really super gratifying watch, in part because I think, you know, there is an increasing discourse on like fatness on television. And for once, this show in particular, I think, extracts us from maybe the kind of sentimental drama of a show like This Is Us, where it's always about self-torture and pain. And in a way, Adie Bryant's character, Annie, really leans into her discovery of joy and selfhood. And I think that that's what's been really fun and affirmative for anyone who watches this show. On top of the fact that Adie Bryant is a national treasure.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
For me, just structurally, it was a very interesting show to me because we've gone in just like the course of the past 10 years from like half-hour comedies being something that you make 22 of during the course of a year to something that you're making only 6 of in a season. And it really changes the kind of storytelling that happens. It's essentially a movie. It is an episodic movie. It is 3 hours long. Like, you only at the end of the first six episodes get to the character of Annie starting to be shrill, which is an interesting change from, you know, network shows of like the 90s or early 2000s that needed to prove themselves in that first moment. That's very interesting to me. And then just the experience of watching a pool party full of fat women be a thing that is beautiful and fun instead of a joke. And I think so much of comedy, like narrative comedy in like the course of the past decade, has been about liberating people who aren't straight white men from being objects to having subjectivity and also having lives that are sort of like explored and reflected upon. And there's also just the fascinating metatext of, do you guys know who Dan Savage is? Okay.
Wow.
You never know. But like, Lindy's boss when she was starting out at The Stranger in Seattle was Dan Savage, who sort of like came for her hard when she was like, stop trying to save fat people and constantly just tell us that the only course of virtue is losing weight. And they had like a kind of public tussle up there in Seattle. And that's sort of being relitigated on the show. And that metatext is fun.
Yeah, with between the boss of this weekly called The Weekly Thorn in Portland, right? It's just slightly off from the original events, played by John Cameron Mitchell, who does this kind of particular role of the fascistic gay guy, you know, who is there kind of insisting upon the different kind of values of gay culture and afflicting and terrorizing the people around him to kind of adhere to that.
Well, it also does an interesting job of counterposing sort of millennialness as a thing of hope and like reconciliation with yourself and Gen X-iness as sort of like sneering judgment, even when that judgment comes back and hits you.
Yeah, they've just been learning all about Gen X, actually, because I'm not sure that they knew much
it
about this.
Horrible.
It was so difficult, right? But I did also want to give a, I wanted to give a special shout out though to my one of my favorite characters, Fran, who plays Annie's roommate, who is a queer woman of color and is played by Lolly Adefope. And she's just amazing and brilliant, and it's really great to have a character who is just inhabiting their own kind of sexuality, their sense, their intersectionality in these various ways without also having to be tortured about it. So,
all right. Well, we wanted to be able to talk to you guys as well because this is a live show and you guys are all human beings, I'm told. But first up, we have an all about from someone here in the audience. Trevor, is you going to come to the aisle and help us out?
Come on up, Trevor.
Trevor, how old are you? 19. You're 19 years old, and what year are you here at USC?
Freshman.
You're a freshman. Trevor, what are you all about this week?
All about this week, all about March Madness and betting on 19-year-old kids. Allegedly.
Wow. What's the name of your March Madness roster?
Exploitation.
Okay.
I mean...
Solid. Mine is March Sadness.
Commodifying barely legal human beings has never gone wrong in this country before, Trevor. I don't know what your problem is. What excites you? What excites you about March Madness?
Seeing some of my friends on TV play a little bit. Seeing people lose games. Watching Old State beat the big school. I mean, it's always fun. Makes lots of money, and I can sit and watch it all day long and do nothing else.
Do you have any predictions for us? Would you like to cast your gaze into the future and tell us?
Yes, LSU will be making the Elite Eight. Duke will be the national champion.
Yeah, Duke, for sure.
Villanova will be in the Final Four.
Of course.
Louisville is probably going to win.
Stop looking at my thing.
Buffalo is going to make it past the first two rounds.
Oh, wow.
And Florida State will be in the Elite Eight.
Trevor, would you like to know what my favorite part of March Madness is?
What's that?
I like when they say, Gonzaga made it. Like, it feels like every 4 or 5 years, there's this story about, well, Gonzaga, what is Gonzaga doing here?
Because literally no one knows about that school.
Yeah. I know, but also it's always the same school that they're surprised made it into something. And I think that they should be surprised by a different school. You take that back to the March Madness guys and let them know, okay? All right, thank you so much, Trevor. A round of applause for Trevor. All right. You guys are listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back to talk about why pop culture matters after this.
Hey, Rocketeers. It's our favorite time of year, and I'm not being facetious here. I mean it. Like, this is kind of one of those exciting times to be on a Max Fun show, at least for me.
Yes.
And it is Max Fun Drive. And the reason it's such a fun drive is precisely because we get to make all sorts of amazing bonus content. And this is the time that we get to reach out to you and talk to you to ask you to become a part of our community, to be part of our Max Fun family. Margaret, tell us a little bit about why it's important to join our community and be really part of our whole world here.
Well, as you guys know, when you listen every week, just about every week we shout out a member of our community for telling us something smart, for opening our eyes to a new piece of pop culture, for just amazing advice about what things to check out. Just recently, we asked people for Angela Lansbury recommendations and they came pouring in. And it's our community is basically our lifeline to culture, in part, in addition to Netflix, of course.
and you know, and it's a real give and take here. Like, so one of the things about becoming a Max Fun supporter, or if you're already a member, upgrading your membership, is that it's not like a kind of faux form of access that you get at all. Like, we really have intense conversations. Some of them are like fun and superficial, where we, you know, kind of talk to each other about like being really into something that we're watching or listening to. But at other times we get into some really heavy material and we negotiate that stuff in such beautiful and peaceful ways, better than you would in your own families or sometimes amongst your own friends.
Absolutely. I feel like every time we have a discussion on the Facebook group that normally I would see go super left on any other social media forum, it always stays is civil and smart, and people bring up really interesting points that I haven't thought about before without being like just horrible to each other.
And you know, these Twitter accounts, the live shows that we do, all the little special extras, they don't come for free, right?
I mean,
we have a dedicated, amazing group of people, including our producer, Swish Swish.
Swish Swish.
And all the great Max Fun production interns and everyone who works on the show. And there's so many benefits to contributing because, you know, like really, it's not just us kind of just hanging out and talking as much as I make this joke about the Carpenters, is that easy listening is hard work. And I think that that's what people forget about podcasts, is that they feel so familiar, but it takes a lot of behind the scenes effort to come to you every week with the freshest content and also off the kind of usual platforms that you listen to us on, we're engaging with you directly, one-on-one. So, you know, I know that a lot of people get kind of annoyed when there's a pledge drive of any kind for any form of like kind of public radio or television. But frankly, my entire life has been transformed by succumbing to these pledge drives, whether or not it's the learning how to cook, because during a PBS drive, I was like, I need the new edition of The Joy of Cooking. Mm-hmm. I guess I'll give, you know, $40 or whatever it is. And it's really so much easier to become a Max Fun member than it was for me to get that Joy of Cooking cookbook. So, you know, Margaret, could you tell our listeners, could you tell our casual listeners how easy it is to become a Max Fun member?
So all you guys have to do is go to MaximumFun.org/donate. Select the membership level that's right for you, then pull out that credit card like you know you do all the time, maybe 10 minutes before you fall asleep sometimes like I do, and some basic information, and voila, you are a member. And then your membership contribution is ongoing all year and will process automatically each month. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to worry about it unless the card expires, you decide to cancel. But why would you do that?
Yeah, exactly. So easy. It's automatic. You know, and as I say automatic, turn that Pointer Sisters Automatic song on that was one of Margaret's jams from Pop Rocket. Anyway, dear friends, please join us. Become an official part of the Max Fun family. Get your own seal of approval. And, not only support your hosts and the panelists of Pop Rocket, but
the community.
Many, many people behind the scenes and all the other people in this community, because it is a community. We thank you for your time, and we look forward to spending more of it with you.
We love you guys. We're so grateful for you.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me here, live on stage at USC's Camilleri Hall, are
Margaret Wappler,
Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh,
and Karen Tongson.
Okay, so we know that you guys have just returned from spring break, but it is time to get back to the very tough work of talking about the serious business of why pop culture matters. Professor Tongson, do you want to set this question up for us?
Well, one of the things that I wanted to talk about, and one of the ways that we organize this class, is it's kind of an impossible task to introduce everyone to U.S. popular culture writ large, which is the category for the class. We could have started in any moment in history. We could have, gone with vaudeville as our starting point. I did want to honor certain major shifts in media starting in the middle of the 20th century and really start with the rise of youth cultures, because I think that that's probably what's most compelling, is when we start paying attention to a youth demo, et cetera. So this class started in the 50s, but we kind of cheated a little bit because we started with the historical material of the 50s and its context, but the first film they watched was Back to the Future.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So part of what we've been talking about, too, is how we imagine the past, or how we kind of figure our relationship to these iconic moments of culture and history in the past. And one of the things that we're totally interested in, too, is how this giant popular culture or monoculture has splintered off and has become a range of different scenes. So, and more niched and more user-driven. So we're trying to track that across history, across different texts. And we just came out of the 90s. And as I mentioned earlier, we just finished our Y2K session with some chatter about The Matrix. So I think that today, what we're going to do is talk a little bit about the 2010s, the decade that we've all been living in, the decade in which most of these students have been sentient. They, I think, got a kick out of the fact that they, once we got to the Spice Girls and Britney, they're like, that is part of my cultural memory. And
really?
I think that that's when the other stuff... That's when I think
so
it started
young.
To kick in. I know, but they are very young, but they all thought Britney came out in the mid-2000s. So,
Oof. So you thought she just went straight to crazy. Wow. That's kind of fun.
Public virginity lasted for 6 to 7 years. It was an important era for Britney.
One of the reasons I wanted to have all of you here.
Yes.
All of your realms of expertise represented is just because as a podcast, we're pretty eclectic. We come from kind of different scenes, even though we have some generational similarity. And so I thought that'd be nice to frame what we think about the 2010s also through who we are as pop culture people.
So should we explain who we are as pop culture people?
I think that'd be nice.
Okay. So I am about the same age as Karen. I grew up sort of the 80s into the 90s, and it really was the time when monoculture broke. It was a period of time when we were all convinced that three television networks and a limited amount of radio was all of the media that anyone had. And subcultural media, things like the black comedy circuit or stuff that was targeted to the queer community, was in largely invisible to white America. And that sort of change. And I think that there is something very definitive for me in that sort of age group of starting with three channels and coming to your level of sentience at 50 channels, which was a very different experience, but it was starting to expose you to stuff that used to be only available in the cities. I'm also from a little farm town in Northern California, so we didn't have cable until I was 18 years old. So you really were just relying on what the three big networks told you you needed to see. And that was pretty much just like family sitcoms and then shows where a person solves a crime. But would you guys like to be horrified? When we watch shows about how a person solved a crime, the whole episode, you knew who had solved the crime. There were other scenes that were showing you. It was not a procedural. You did not solve the problem with the people of CSI. Like, you watched the moonlighting guys flirt and knew that just around the corner was a bad guy with a gun. So, like, I think for me, the big changes were the video store showing up that allowed you to select things and allowed movies that had been more niche or smaller budget to show up in a little farm town. Cable, passively showing you things. Passive watching of television was a really important thing for me. I don't know what place it has in your life, but just like letting a movie show up and being like, oh shit, I'm watching The Addiction now, a weird mid-90s indie movie about how being a graduate student is like being a vampire. go find it. Have you seen it?
No.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's, oh, no, it's Lily Taylor. It was directed by Abel Ferreira, I think. And like,
oh,
it,
yeah.
It's not good, but it's fascinating,
yes.
Which is what most of the 90s was. it was a whole lot of, what am I watching? And then Karen and I share a deep love of Entertainment Weekly, which was a very important document before we had networks to inform us about
internet.
Yes. I've decided somehow it's more sophisticated to say networks because saying the internet makes me feel like it's 1994. But it was like a roundup of everything happening in pop culture that week and sort of, you know, was a shift from things being monthly or things being a section of a weekly magazine or newspaper to sort of saying more media is coming at you. You need to keep track of this and also know who Parker Posey is. And the ability to know who Parker Posey was in rural America was an important and significant change of the 1990s that I benefited from. Anyone else?
Well, I mean, I would say that my first intro to pop culture was definitely through sitcom TV. Basically, that was my babysitter after school. I think you guys are growing up in an era where your parents maybe fear you being online too much. And in our time, it was like TV was this big worry. Like, don't let them watch too much TV. It'll rot their brains. But my parents did give me a nice 2-3 hour allotment, basically, when they were busy making dinner, taking care of their lives, so forth and so on. And I just inhaled all of those sitcoms, everything like Growing Pains and Facts of Life and Silver Spoons. And I still just like Family Ties. I'll just walk around the house sometimes and like sing those like theme songs to myself because they're just deeply implanted in my brain, probably taking up valuable space that I could use for something else at this point. So sitcom TV was like a big entry point for me, and I noticed from a young age that I sort of watched it in a different way than like my two older brothers did. I just gravitated to it more. The narratives meant more to me. The stories really connected to me. And then later on in life, I would say high school, college, it was really music that took over. And particularly, you know, I was in high school in the 90s, in the early 90s, and Riot Girl was a big thing. A lot of like feminist punk music was a big thing. And I just soaked myself in that world. I got really into Sleater-Kinney and Courtney Love's Hole.
They know who Carrie Bronstein is.
Oh, great. Yeah. Yeah. Carrie Bronstein.
Noted sketch performer Carrie Bronstein used to be a musician.
Yeah. And a marvelous one at that. La Tigra, PJ Harvey, all these female musicians that I just felt really empowered by listening to their music. And there was also sort of like a twin movement to all of that, which was in magazines. And it was basically like Bust Magazine, which you still see around, Venus, a music magazine that I worked with. All of these really exciting feminist magazines that basically would put certain kind of women on the cover that like Rolling Stone would never touch. And that inspired me to get into journalism and to basically finally see that my voice had value out there in the world.
Can I explain what a magazine is?
Please do.
As staples.
Imagine if BuzzFeed were several hundred different organizations and they all published things on paper. That's a hilarious joke. You guys should like that more. A real life comedian is making up jokes for you while you're in class. I'm sorry.
I was born in 80, so So my parents were really obsessed with entertainment in all forms, but it was technology where they really got to sort of also be lightweight hoarders. So record players, tape decks, 8-tracks, you know, we had every single possible thing you could ever have because my mom bought it always new and immediately, and then bought all the accompanying media for it. So I really gravitated towards music heavily in my household, and my parents both have different tastes. My mom is much more jazzy, easy listening, yacht roddy. My dad is a little bit more yacht roddy and into oldies. And then just the emergence of pop music at that time. There was so much amazing music that was sort of colliding on one another, and especially being on the West Coast, it was rap. There was rock, metal rock, there was hair rock. So I grew up listening to sort of a makeup, a smattering of everything. And by the time I was 10 or 11 years old, I was listening to Guns N' Roses and Bjork and Oasis and Nirvana and Lauryn Hill, Alanis Morissette. All the big, and still Madonna, and still Michael Jackson and Prince. But I will say that high concept, big budget films were what my parents made the time for us to go see, and they would want to see again. So if their Back to the Future came out, Alien came out, anything that was big budget, it was because we had cable, and I was literally born in a house with every single channel. Sorry.
Well, but I think it's also interesting for them to understand that TV shows like lasted a longer time, that movies came out and movies stayed for like months at a time.
You could see the same movie for you could see, like, Crocodile Dundee came out when I was 6, and it was out for literally like 9 months. I'm sorry, it was out. People talked about it all the time.
I saw Dirty Dancing in the theaters 8 times.
Yeah. Wow. I saw Dumb and Dumber 10 times. That movie was hilarious.
It did just sort of like, they were like bulldozers that would like define the popular culture for everyone in the country in this like, this most public way. We had monoculture.
One last thing, KT. Oh, no, horror films. There was an era where horror films were fucking disgusting, and then it was aliens, and then it was zombies, and then it kind of swerved back to vampires, then it became stupid, and it was like MTV. Then Scream came out. Then I was like, my mind was blown by Scream. And then now we're leading up to Us. And it's just to see from 1980 and going beyond that and looking back at old, you know, Dario Argento films that were crazy and disgusting and Fulci and just disgusting and everything Romero did, now to where we're at, where you're watching socially conscious horror movies directed by fans of horror movies that are about with black leads. I never, ever thought. The black guy died all the time when I was growing up. But now I'm seeing movies where the black guy is the hero. And those are the things that I'm happy about. You know, he always died. I'm not exaggerating. You watch any black movie before, they would die or vary to the very end or die in the very beginning.
I mean, they hear so much from me, so I don't really want to dwell too much on this, but I will share part of my story that I don't share as much, I guess, and that is, you know, I wasn't born in the United States, so my experience of U.S. pop culture was really as somebody who's living in a former territory of the United States out in the Philippines, and so my first immersion into TV in the late 70s was my entree into imagining what life would be like if and when we eventually moved here. And so the impression I got was through Charlie's Angels, Chips, and shows like that, right? And I totally,
we got
like,
pulled over a lot, yeah, is what you thought.
No, it was just, or I was just like, I want to ride a motorcycle and I want to hang out with those three ladies. And that was pretty much like, I was like, where is America? Point me there.
Those shows took place so outside. Like, yeah. More outside
yes.
than TV we make today.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, it was just so, it was like visions of the San Fernando Valley.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. There's so much wind and sun.
Cannon,
and
riptide,
freeways.
Hunter.
Yeah. So I think that, and it was very surprising to me when I moved here that life wasn't quite like that, as I think many people experience when they immigrate to the United States. And so, but that was really the starting point. And so I think that it was, you know, the kind of power differential too was always like, you know, like, I began to realize then that once I did get here, that all of those images that I'd really cathected onto were very different from how I was or how I looked. And so those different kind of stages of realization happened throughout my consumption of pop culture over the course of time. And so I think my ethos is, or what I bring to talking about pop culture, and I hope that my students get this, is that, you know, yes, there are works that are terrible and problematic and, you know, hemmed in by the limitations, the intellectual and cultural limitations of their time, but we have to learn how to be able to talk about this stuff in a way that can also preserve the pleasure and the joy and the friction that these popular texts provide for us.
Well, also, just part of that conversation today, being able to realize and accept that all of the people who were laughing at that stuff in 2005, or the vast majority of them, are still around and still participating in this culture, and how to reconcile those things and be able to deal honestly with people's capacity for change and growth in understanding their own world.
Yeah, no. And so, yeah, so hopefully that comes across in every time that we have the conversation in the context of the class, in between all of the volumes of history and material that I have them consume and watch. Because one of the things I think it's important for younger people now to have a historical relationship to pop culture, to know what people watched in the 60s and to watch it themselves, or to watch what people watched in the 70s or 80s or 90s. And so I know it's kind of annoying. You guys have to watch a lot of stuff for class, but it is a way, I think, of just reconnecting in a direct way to that popular culture instead of just kind of seeing the reboot.
So what from the 20-teens is gonna last?
In terms of a trend, I would definitely point towards streaming platforms as being very much a 2010s invention, and it changed completely the way we digest pop culture. I mean, basically with the invention of Spotify, Netflix, Hulu, all of these ways that we now get our entertainment, we just have this way faster turn cycle that we're burning through pop culture. It's almost unthinkable now to remember the 90s or even the aughts and think about waiting a week to watch the next installment of your favorite TV show. Like, I can barely remember that feeling, even though I think, like, you know, HBO and Game of Thrones and some shows like that can still get away with it. I do think, however, that, you know, we're seeing a moment right now where streaming is going to shift a bit. And what I mean by that is, you know, when One Day at a Time got canceled by Netflix, you know, it's just last week, it was a critically beloved show. It was a show that Netflix was designed almost to protect, you know, a super diverse writer's room, an almost entirely Latinx cast. That's a type of show that is supposed to survive and thrive on Netflix, and it couldn't. And I think it's because in some ways we're seeing that the honeymoon is kind of over. They had this like huge banquet of money, and they were able to do things like not even release viewership numbers. But now it's like, and you know, in 2018, they released like some, you know, 700 original TV shows. 700 original TV shows. And that is a massive amount of content. And it's just inevitable that we're going to see that bubble pop or at least deflate.
But it's also a weird reflection of the fact that we don't know how to make television shows for this different way of watching them. Or we know how to watch how to make specific kinds of television shows. We understand sort of House of Cards, thinky drama, that kind of thing. But One Day at a Time was this weird, did anyone here watch it? Okay, I watch every goddamn episode because I also love multicam sitcoms like that for the same reason that Margaret was talking about. But like it was both a relic and a thing deeply of now, in that it was a multicam sitcom that had like speeches that talked about real things, like in a way that you used to get in the 70s. Did you make them watch any 70s sitcoms?
Yeah, Laverne and Shirley.
Nice.
Watch a goddamn episode of Maude, okay?
Like, I knew that you would complain about the fact that I didn't make them watch Maude.
But like, One Day at a Time was just this really good thing that no one knew how to watch. Like, we had created a thing that a family could watch together at a point in time when families don't watch things together, you know?
Yeah, I mean, to continue off that point about Netflix and just the kind of TV that they're showing us and valuing, I mean, I think what's happening is that Netflix has been able to sort of get away with making huge profits and Warner and the other big traditional studios are starting AOL to go, wait a minute, yeah. Like these are our crown jewels, mm-hmm. and we should be the ones making money off of this stuff. So you saw recently that Warner and Netflix had sort of a tussle about Friends, you know, which you could stream on Netflix, and Warner basically was like, okay, we'll give this to you for a little bit longer, but like sort of in the back planning rooms, they're clearly trying to come up with their own technology for taking that tremendously successful show and reaping all the rewards off of it themselves. So I think we're going to see more of that Netflix is going to get kind of broken apart and not allowed to carry some of that kind mm-hmm. of stuff.
Well, there's also something so fascinating about the fact that we are using so much of our brain power to figure out how to reposition the existing properties that we know are valuable. Every one of you has seen every episode of Friends, I'm going to assume. And like, we're just trying to figure out different ways that we can make money off of that instead of understanding what a half hour comedy with jokes is today, because we don't make those anymore. To bring up a specific piece of culture, I think something that will last is Game of Thrones, because it managed to like take fantasy and take it away like from straight white guys. And like a lot of the work was done by the Lord of the Rings trilogy and then those shitty Hobbit movies, sort of making fantasy pervasive. And then the fact that Game of Thrones did an interesting job of consistently chopping away what you assumed was the central narrative, of taking the person who you have been culturally like taught to assume is the center of the story, and then sort of like queer your approach to the narrative. Did they include people of color in that? Not really. But I think the other thing it did was take realpolitik and apply that to a world of fantasy, which we needed at a point in time when we had sort of like these two big cultural trends of let's try to do the right thing and then sort of a politics that was just about end results. And it gave us a game where politics was all about end results that was removed from our own world. House of Cards isn't adorable when worse shit is going on in real life. The West Wing is not fun to watch when it is just porn about what it would be like if we had somebody who cared in the presidency. And Game of Thrones is sort of like a hoary, like professional wrestling take on what politics actually is now, and it's deeply satisfying to watch.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a lover of Game of Thrones too. You'll see here that this side of the table cares about Game of Thrones and this side of the table does not. But I think one of the things that's really fascinating about it and why it'll stand the test of time too is that, you know, as much as it did graft certain political ideas onto itself that are from now, it's also timeless. You could watch it at any moment 10, 15 years from now, and no matter what's going on, there's going to be relatable content in that show, because it's just about human nature. It's just about people, you know, calling from their worst selves and sometimes their best selves, but honestly, on Game of Thrones, usually their worst selves. But also
getting the job done.
Right, and also wolves. Hello, beautiful wolves. So there's just so much to sell it, and I also think just on a pure sort of performance and production value, it is really a cut above nearly everything else that's come out around it. I mean, they've spent, you know, tons of money making that show look really amazing and hiring actors who are probably all going to go on to do really esteemed things.
Well, that is another interesting change of the 2010s is not having mid-level production anymore. It's now either like a dude in their living room, like just, you know, creating their own YouTube narrative, or like a bunch of corporations getting together to give us Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Pratt and Chris Pine and many other Chrises. Winner, what do you think is going to last?
I think that you guys are going to really start to appreciate television that either you didn't pay attention to or television that you can binge and start and get into in a more invested way. I just recently binged Mad Men and Veep, and I just never paid attention to those shows while they were on because a lot of them debuted when it was starting to get a bit chaotic or I got distracted. from it while it started being chaotic just in the world. So if you ever notice, like, when a president changes over to an opposite party, the culture sort of follows along with it. So watching content that was right before 2016, it does make you think of a time that was a lot more innocent. And then you start looking at what your consumption is once that person has gotten in an office and started doing everything, if it doesn't feel comfortable for you. There might be somebody in here who voted for Trump, and that's fine if you did. But if you're thinking about when an era shifts, 2008, getting Obama in office, and then going into 2016 with Trump in office, I'm looking at things in a much more nostalgic way, and I think you will start to find that shift in 2017 when people had to pivot, most likely liberal media had to pivot into a way to how to deal with this. You'll never forget that. This is probably one of the first times in your lifetime that you were born and there was a black president, or there was a president, we got our first black president. Now you're moving into an era where we're dealing with a different kind of audience that we have to bring into the fold, and you're seeing how networks have to balance the liberal versus the conservative and who's just going very far right and who's just going very far left. When I look at Mad Men and I think about Mad Men to me is reflective of sort of the moment we're in right now. They went through a lot of changes, even though it's from the lens of white men and primarily white women. They made, I think the one thing that they did, the makers of that show did really well, is they gave you perspective, usually from everyone's lens, depending on the scenario. And you also saw a cultural shift that was happening in the 60s into the 70s, and people dealing with their real lives and then going to work and having to work in a corporate structure. You'll never really have to work in a corporate environment like that again. Everything that you guys decide to do or decide to go work in as young, there's many people of color here, and there's also many Caucasian people here. You will not enter an experience quite like what we saw in the 60s and the 70s Mary Tyler Moore show. You won't see a show like Working, a movie like Working Girl. Things like that won't
we
really...
watched that.
Yeah, my number one favorite movie. You won't see. You're not going to see that in mass much more, what women and men are having to deal with. There's still going to be microaggressions, but it's fun to look back and see how far we've actually really come.
What questions do you guys have for us? Trevor.
Being a really big comedy fan and growing up and watching stand-up like for my entire life, I feel like we're in this era now where everyone seems to, because everyone identifies with so many different things, that we try to be offended by everything. But do you guys think that, like, this will continue to where it just kills, like, people saying remotely anything that people disagree with?
That is an interesting question that I am professionally having to deal with on a daily basis. And I think one time I was doing a show, and I was crowd working somebody, and I asked their name, and a low voice said their name was Olivia. And I, as a stand-up comedian, am trained to tear into that person. But also, I had seen a trans woman there earlier, and was like, oh, it's also just probably that. And it was that. And she's a very funny comedian. Her name is Olivia Hader, and you guys should check her out. But I think just being able to, on both sides, seek communication instead of aggression is important. And I think that comedy at its best does have to be able to problematize issues and not just accept them as given, if that makes any sense.
I'm not even talking about just people. Like, even, like, particular events. Because the people I like, people hate.
Like who?
Anthony Jeselnik, Louis C.K., Jim Jeffries. So...
Jeselnik has blocked me on Twitter, so it turns out he's not comfortable joking about everything.
But it's like, when you watch, like, people will get offended by Louis C.K. sets, but it's like, when you really pay attention and see what he's trying to say, people understand that, like, he's trying to make a point, and they take those things completely off of what he's...
Well, I think people understand it differently, because I think some people, like, see that he's trying to make a point that is progressive, and other people are perfectly capable of listening to and receiving the same material and saying, I don't like the tools that he's using for that. Like, did you listen to his sets from Long Island? Okay, yeah, there's a big long run there, essentially sexually marginalizing a big chunk of the world as it exists, using really old school hack? I mean, the thing is with so much of this comedy stuff, it's like, how much of it is hack? How much are you just telling a joke that people have been telling since the 1940s with nothing bringing it forward? You know, I think that people are allowed to and should criticize that. I've talked too much about this. Anyone else?
No, I mean, I think that your expertise in that area, I would prefer not to say any more right now. So
anyone else? Moved with the Spirit.
We should probably get to our jams because they actually have other classes to go to today.
You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this. You guys, Maximum Fun, it takes you guys, our listeners, to support us. And so we pick a time every year for Max Fun Drive. It's only once a year. We give you our best shows. We give you great thank you gifts. It's a celebration of all things Maximum Fun. And the best time to sign on is a member. So if you're already a member, you can also upgrade. That's an option too.
So what are some of the incentives that our listeners will get if they choose to upgrade their membership or join for the first time?
Well, first of all, you don't have to have a lot of money to give away for this. You can really just jump in on the $5 a month level, and we will be so happy you did. And for $5 a month, you're going to get exclusive bonus content, which this year includes our slumber party episode, which was pretty damn lit and also made me do some embarrassing things on social media that you will have to go and track back and see, as well as Guy. For $10 a month, you will get a really adorable pin designed by Megan Lynn Cott. It's a brand new design for each show, ours included, and this one has the Pop Rocket approved, basically playing off of our Pop Rocket seal of approval. And so you slap that on your jean jacket, and that's your signal to your buds that you've been approved by the show.
For $20 a month, you can get a beautiful 18 by 24 inch, 550-piece Maximum Fun puzzle. Which, honestly, doesn't that sound like a fun evening?
That does sound like a fun evening. I mean, you know, like, I'm not a big puzzle person, but also I'm just like, what would be in a Maximum Fun puzzle? I feel like I would donate money just to figure that out.
It's a super cool image. It, like, looks like a Radiohead cover or something.
I mean, it's cool.
Maybe the Ms. Saigon poster. Who knows?
Designed by Jeffrey Tice. Mm.
I would like it if it were just a tastefully draped Jordan and Jesse. You know? For $35 a month, you can get a glass coffee mug engraved with the Maximum Fun Rocket logo to just let everyone at your work know I am an antisocial nerd. I have chosen to have friends who live on a different coast from me. And I like
who live in a different country. We have so many Brit Rocketeers. You know what? Like, you could invest in Max Fun and it would cost much less for you.
At $50 a month, you get the engraved Maximum Fun membership card. You know, if things continue politically to break down in this country and we come to a number of successor states, one of which is run by Karen Togson, you're going to need that membership card to say, hey, I am cool with Hair Dictator and, the genetically altered cats that run, you know, security for her. Move along.
It looks like one of those rose quartz Amex cards. Frankly, it looks cooler than one of them. And anytime you're like, you know, you could probably pass it off as one. Not encouraging you to do that.
Yeah.
I believe this is what they call millennial pink.
Yeah.
So therefore you can flash it at the next Firefest and probably get a whole island for
yourself. Isn't it like that card?
yeah, exactly. It's like Billy McFarlane's card, but way better.
We are not running a scam though.
It's worth way more. Exactly.
Maximum Fun is a Firefest that you can go to with your ears any week out of the year. At the $100 a month level, you become a part of the inner circle. You become part of the Maximum Fun Culture Club. If you become a member of the Maximum Fun Culture Club, the hosts of Max Fun Podcast will curate for you monthly cultural gifts, like things that you need to have in your life will come like little presents from a podcast network that loves you.
So many presents. Speaking of presents, you know, if you're a part of our Maximum Fun community, if you're part of our Pop Rocket community specifically, you get to join in on things like what Margaret set up for us was like our little gift-giving exchange.
That's right. We have so many cool little community things going on, like the gift exchange we did for Valentine's Day, the Pop Rocket Book Club. We're going to be rolling out more of those kinds of things to get you guys involved, because it's such a great community that we want to keep it nice and close-knit.
And like the ultimate expression of that community is, of course, Max FunCon. And if you go to the $200 a month level, you get automatic registration for Maximum FunCon. If you're on the West Coast, that means that you could watch me dance in a high-altitude environment with low oxygen.
Yes.
It's extremely dangerous for everyone involved.
Worth all the money.
We need people to start their memberships or upgrade their memberships now. You guys, it's going to slip your mind. You're going to forget about this. Go do it right now. Go to MaximumFun.org/donate and let them know that you love all of these podcasts. Welcome back to Pop Rocket, live here at USC. Now, every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what's your jam? But this week, we would like to start out by asking one of you, the students here, Clayton. How old are you?
I'm 22 today.
Congratulations.
Happy birthday.
Yay, happy birthday.
I was going to say, you're like a Luke Perry 17.
Clayton, what is your current jam?
So my current jam is What's Up by Four Non Blondes. When Professor Tongson said she'd be taking suggestions for today's Daily Jam, immediately that was the song that came to my head, especially the chorus, What's Going On. And I know we were trying to not go towards the scandals at USC, but I felt like that was a very relevant song with our current situation.
Trying to get up that great big hill of hope for a destination. I realized quickly when I knew I should that the world was made up of this brotherhood of man, for whatever that means. Into a crisis.
You guys will never truly understand how beige and gray the 1990s were.
No. I just want to say really quickly that you guys, no matter what is in the news, you should be so proud to go to this school and so proud that you have a professor like Dr. Karen Tongson.
Thank you.
So true.
Well, and I will always stand up for my students, and I thank you all for being such a tremendous, tremendous resource of the university, and we need to listen to the students and the faculty more
here at
the school. So here we go, USC.
Keep fighting the power.
All right, let's listen to the faculty more. Karen, what's your current jam?
Well, since we're talking about the 2010s, I think that one of the things, I agree with Karen, that one of the things that we're going to remember is some sort of revival of the musical. And this song is a popular song from a different artist, but I'm choosing the version that was popularized by a little guy we know named Darren Criss on Glee. And this is his and the Warblers' rendition of Teenage Dream.
Let's go all the way tonight. No regrets, just love. We can dance until we die. You and I will be young forever.
An important part of going to college on the West Coast is not giving a shit about a cappella music. And I think that's what we should have real pride in. Winter, what is your current jam?
I picked Beyonce and Frank Ocean's Superpower from her album Beyonce. The reason I chose this song is Frank Ocean. I think the way he wrote this song and the addition he brings to it is incredibly beautiful. Superpower.
shot. Ooh, like a bear, a tough love.
And I thought the world would revolve.
I thought the world would revolve.
Without us.
Without us, without us, without us.
But nothing I know could slow us down. Couldn't slow us down. I thought I could live without you.
I just want to add really quick that I was actually going to say that Lemonade from Beyoncé is the pop culture artifact I would say is definitely going to last outside of the tens. I feel like the moment that...
What happened? He was like...
Really?
He gave
really?
You a consequent nod. I don't know about that.
The only people who talk about Lemonade are literally white people.
Really? I don't know. I mean, I think that that's an interesting comment because I feel like part of what makes it so valuable is because it landed right at like Black Lives Matter like height. You know what I mean? Like it.
That's the one, and it's not even the best of most of the ones.
Well, I mean, okay. So I
see,
think part of
push back now.
Trevor,
they're, now
I
they're
disagree,
feeling
Trevor, cocky. But I am a white woman. But I do think that like part of the reason that particular album is so powerful is because it's multimedia, it's multi-genre. She claimed her territory. She basically said, I'm a powerful black woman that can do whatever the fuck I want. I can work with Jack White. I can work with Kendrick Lamar. I can be on top of a sinking cop car in the middle of Houston. Whatever it is that I want to do, I can do it. So I think it is just a really powerful statement from somebody at the top of her game at the
and
time.
Also just see her, the thing I will say about Lemonade, which is important, Bjork did the same thing. Bjork used to write albums about being in love all the time. And then the first time Matthew Barney tried to take it there, she fucked him up. Mm-hmm. So when you look at Beyonce and on Beyonce being in love, drunk in love, I'm so in love, we're so powerful. And then to turn around and have to jam him up in Lemonade, it's just like when with Britney and Blackout. Look at Britney and Blackout. She was unhinged. And that was, to me, one of the best albums she's ever made.
We only have the venue for 10 more minutes, so I don't get a jam. Right, Margaret, what's your jam?
This is Lizzo, who all of us have embraced on this panel, and hopefully you guys are turned on to the Lizzo too. I just think she is so wonderful, so fierce, so joyful, and this is her song, 'Cause I Love You, from her upcoming album.
What the fuck are fucking feelings, yo? Once upon a time I was a hoe. I don't even want a hoe no more. Got you something from the liquor store. Little bit of Lizzo and some more. Trying to open up a little more. Sorry if my heart a little slow. I thought that
we've been talking about what's going to be remembered from the 2010s, but I think Lizzo is going to close it out hard and is going to be one of the big first artists of the 2020s.
Thank you guys so much for coming out today. We really appreciate it. For our first live show ever, you guys were such a great audience. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You have been listening to and watching Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Brandon, with Margaret Wappler, Winter Mitchell, Rohrbaugh, and Karen Tongson. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to everyone for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. This week, we would like to thank LinkedIn Fan. This show makes me so happy. The amazing Guy Branum, the erudite Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh, the effervescent Margaret Wappler, the brilliant Karen Tongson, and the amazing roster of Fifth Beatles make the show much more than just a weekly update on pop culture. I have laughed and cried and listened to this show. Have been introduced to so much culture. It's truly a highlight of my week when this show ends up in my feeds. Love y'all. And Start Arc said, I listen every week in hopes of hearing Guy's deep laugh, but soon realized I loved everyone's laugh. Also, it is Maximum Fun Drive. Please contribute to Maximum Fun. It allows wonderful live events like this to happen. And if you want us to hear your feedback or even ask a panelist for advice, you can call 530-237-4108. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and get in the discussion. We're a production of MaximumFun.org, and our senior producer is Laura Swisher. Clap for her.
Please clap.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.